You might already be able to tell that I was born with a silver spoon up my ass. I offer no apologies. After 3,000 years of dabbling with democracy, the remaining old Earth families had come to the realization that the only way to avoid such riffraff was not to allow them to breed. Or rather, to sponsor seed ship fleets. Spin ship explorations, new Farcaster migrations, all of the panicked urgency of the Hegira, as long as they bred out there and left old Earth alone. The fact that the home world was a diseased old bitch, gone in the teeth, didn't hurt the riffraff's urge to pioneer. No fools they. And like the Buddha, I was almost grown before I saw my first hint of poverty. I was 16 standard years old, on my Vandayar, and backpacking through India, when I saw a beggar. The Hindu old families kept them around for religious reasons, but all I knew at the time was that here was a man in rags, ribs showing, holding out a wicker basket with an ancient credit disky in it, begging for a touch of my universal card. My friends thought it was hysterical. I threw up. It was in Benares. My childhood was privileged, but not obnoxiously so. I have pleasant memories of Grandam Sybil's famous parties. She was a great aunt on my mother's side. I remember one 3-day affair she threw in the Manhattan archipelago. Guests ferried in by dropship from Orbit City, from the European arcologies. I remember the Empire State Building rising from the water, its many lights reflecting on the lagoons and fern canals. The EMVs unloading passengers on the observation deck, while cooking fires burned on the overgrown island mounds of lower buildings all around. The North American Preserve was our private playground in those days. It was said that about 8,000 people still resided in that mysterious continent, but half of these were rangers. The rest included the renegade Arnists, who plied their trade by resurrecting species of plants and animals long absent from their antediluvian North American haunts. The ecology engineers, licensed primitives such as the Ogallala Sioux or the Hell's Angel Guild, and the occasional tourist. I had a cousin who reportedly backpacked from one observation zone to the other in the preserve, but he did so in the Midwest, where the zones were relatively close together and where the dinosaur herds were much scarcer. In the first century, after the big mistake, Gaia was mortally injured, but slow in the dying. The devastation was great during the bad times, and these came more often in precisely plotted spasms, shorter remissions, more terrible consequences after each attack. But the Earth abided and repaired itself as best it could. The preserve was, as I say, our playground, but in a real sense, so was all of the dying Earth. Mother let me have my own EMV when I was 7, and there was no place on the globe farther than an hour's flight from home. My best friend, Amalfi Schwartz, lived in the Mount Erebus Estates in what had once been the Antarctic Republic. We saw each other daily. The fact that old Earth law forbade Farcasters did not bother us in the least. Lying on some hillside at night, looking up through the 10,000 orbiting lights and the 20,000 beacons of the ring, at the 2,000 or 3,000 visible stars, we felt no jealousy, no urge to join the Hegira, that even then was spinning the Farcaster's silk of the world web. We were happy. My memories of Mother are oddly stylized, as if she were another fictional construct from one of my Dying Earth novels. Perhaps she was. Perhaps I was raised by robots in the automated cities of Europe, suckled by androids in the Amazon desert, or simply grown in a vat like brewer's yeast. What I recall is Mother's white gown, sliding ghost-like through the shadowed rooms of the estate. Infinitely delicate blue veins on the back of her thin-fingered hand as she poured tea in the damask and dust light of the conservatory. Candlelight caught like a gold fly in the spider-web sheen of her hair, hair done up in a bun in the style of the grand dames. Sometimes I dream that I remember her voice, the lilt and tone and turn in the womb centeredness of it. But then I awake, and it becomes only the wind moving lace curtains or the sound of some alien sea on stone. From my earliest sense of self, I knew that I would be, should be, a poet. It was not as if I had a choice, more like the dying beauty all about breathed its last breath in me, and commanded that I be doomed to play with words the rest of my days, as if in expiation for our race's thoughtless slaughter of its crib world. So what the hell? I became a poet. I had a tutor whose name was Balthazar, human but ancient, a refugee from ancient Alexandria's flesh-scented alleys. Balthazar all but glowed blue-white from those crude, early Poulsen treatments. He was like an irradiated mummy of a man, sealed in liquid plastic, and Randy as the proverbial goat. Centuries later, when I was in my satyr period, I felt that I finally understood poor Don Balthazar's priapic compulsions. But in those days it was mostly a hindrance to keeping young girls on the estate staff. Human or android, Don Balthazar did not discriminate. He poinked them all. Luckily for my education, there was nothing homosexual in Don Balthazar's addiction to young flesh, so his escapades evidenced themselves either as absences from our tutorial sessions or an inordinate amount of attention lavished on memorizing verses from Ovid, Senish, or Wu. He was an excellent tutor. We studied the ancients and the late classical period, took field trips to the ruins of Athens, Rome, London, and Hannibal, Missouri, and never once had a quiz or test. Don Balthazar expected me to learn everything by heart at first encounter, and I did not disappoint him. He convinced my mother that the pitfalls of progressive education were not for an old earth family, so I never knew the mind-stunting shortcuts of RNA medication, datasphere immersion, systemic flashback training, stylized encounter groups, higher-level thinking skills at the expense of facts, or preliterate programming. As a result of these deprivations, I was able to recite all of Fitzgerald's translation of the Odyssey by the time I was 6, compose a sestina before I could dress myself, and think in spiral fugue verse before I ever interfaced with an AI. My scientific education, on the other hand, was something less than stringent. Don Balthazar had little interest in what he referred to as the mechanical side of the universe. I was 22 before I realized that computers, RMUs, and Uncle Koa's asteroidal life support devices were machines, and not some benevolent manifestations of the animus around us. I believed in fairies, wood sprites, numerology, astrology, and the magic of Midsummer's Eve, deep in the primitive forests of the NAP. Like Keats and Lamb in Hayden's studio, Don Balthazar and I drank toasts to the confusion of mathematics, and mourned the destruction of the poetry of the rainbow by M. Newton's prying prism. The early distrust and actual hatred of all things scientific and clinical served me well in later life. It is not difficult, I have learned, to remain a pre-Copernican pagan in the post-scientific hegemony.